to have continued access to me, they would pay her electric bill and her rent.
Oh my goodness. So they were basically paying her off.
Yeah. She sold me. She knew exactly what was going on. And boy, does that throw you into, emotionally, does that throw you into a tailspin to know that your own mother participated and was rewarded financially for access to a child?
Welcome to another episode of Resilience in the Shadows, the podcast by Tent Makers. I'm your host, Alex Payton, accompanied by my co-host, Letitia Payton. Today, we embark on a journey guided by the remarkable resilience of an individual whose life embodies strength, courage, and unwavering determination. Join us in extending a heartfelt welcome to our honored guest, Richard Windman. Richard's multifaceted identity adds depth to his remarkable story of resilience as a proud Texan, computer scientist, musician, aviator, romantic, and according to him, a hell of a nice guy. Richard's journey through the shadows of trauma and adversity began in his hometown of New Orleans, where he confronted the harrowing reality of childhood sexual abuse. Despite the darkness that threatened to engulf him, Richard's spirit remained unbroken, fueled by an innate resilience to guide him through the darkest of times. As a survivor, Richard's story transcends mere survival. It embodies triumph over adversity, resilience in the face of unimaginable pain, and the relentless pursuit of healing and justice. His journey from victim to advocate is a testament to the transformative power of resilience and unwavering human spirit. Today, we have the privilege of delving into Richard's extraordinary life, from his early years in New Orleans to his journey of self-discovery and advocacy. We will explore the depths of his experiences, the challenges he has overcome, and the wisdom he has gained. So now let us dive into this profound conversation with Richard Windman on Resilience in the Shadows. Thanks for joining us, Richard.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into anything, can we have some background? What was your childhood like? What are you doing now? And what were some formative experiences in your early life?
Well, that's a really big, wide question. So my early childhood was, we were poor. We grew up in the poorest part of Mid-City, New Orleans, Louisiana. But life was good. You know, we were happy. And, you know, we'd jump out of bed with just our shorts on, no socks or shoes or shirt. And when we got thirsty, we would drink out of the faucet on the side of the house. And it was fun, glorious times. And then at age 7, that's when the abuse started. It lasted until I was 17. Do you have 6 hours to talk about the abuse? No, you don't. We're not talking about a man or a couple of men. We're talking about hundreds, if not over 1,000 men, spanning the Boy Scouts, the police detective, Stanley Burkhart, and then the Jesuit priest. It's a hard tale to tell, but I do it all the time. And I was, when I started my organization, SESA, I thought that I was in a position of authority, that nobody had a story as bad as mine. And boy, I was quickly humbled to hear the stories of the other victims and survivors who had it even worse than me. So the abuse stopped at 17. I mentally couldn't deal with it. At 19, I attempted suicide. And I'm not saying a cry out for help. I literally intended to die. And they found me and they saved me. So what do you do with that? So there's two ways that you deal with it. You know, it's either, you know, put a butt on your band-aid on your butt, get on with life, file it away, or it becomes a repressed memory. I decided to deal with it as the former. I would file it away. I wouldn't let it affect me. And I would get on with my life. And I went on to have a, I went to college, got my PhD. I had a brilliant, brilliant computer scientist career in the IT field. Worked for the biggest names in the world and for over 30 years now. And but the thing is, one day you're going to have to deal with this, no matter whether you file it away or whether it's repressed. And typically, according to the experts, that's your late 40s and early 50s. And for me, it hit me hard at 47. The Jerry Sandusky case. You know, as a victim or survivor, as you're matriculating through life, you can't help but watch the news. And you hear it all the time. Oh, a gym teacher molested a child. Oh, a teacher, a priest molested a child. And it goes on and on and on. It's almost every night. But there was something about the Sandusky case that really triggered me. And it forced me to re-examine my abuse as a child. I told my wife at the time that I needed to tell my story. She's severely Catholic. Sorry, I'm severely Catholic. I am severely faithful. And she told me at 47, but you will not go public and you will not tell your story because you're not going to put that shame on our family. You're not going to do it. And so I started hitting the bottle really hard. You know, it's a, you know, victims and survivors, you know, first there's the abuse. There's the misplaced shame and guilt. And thus it's a secret and you can't tell anybody and you can't reach out for help. You can't. And so what do? You have to ease the pain. And that's done through a myriad of ways. It's done through drugs, alcohol, risky behaviors. You know, and I matriculated through life. And when I went public with my story, everybody in my past life went, aha, I knew that there was something going on with you, you know? So it's an awkward existence. Today, I'm an advocate. We have a very strong organization. We have 37,000 members, majority in the United States. And it's just really horrifying to be an advocate. You know, I had my journey and I was somewhat healed. Healed is a term that's kind of final. So I won't say healed. I'm well along in my journey towards healing. The DSM-5 describes all these psychological disorders that victims and survivors experience every day in their life, but it doesn't outline the treatment or the cure. What we have, according to medical and psychological sciences right now, is we'll have this for the rest of our life. And so I'm in a continuum of trying to manage my trauma while trying to run the organization. And here's the deal. When you do these support meetings every single week, and you hear the other stories and their trauma, it causes vicarious trauma in me. It's an ugly place to be in, but Leticia believes in hope. And there is hope. I mean, there are ways that you can successfully manage it. You know, you get a doctor. Get some meds. Learn how to meditate. Learn how to ground yourself. Learn box breathing. You know, into a dance therapy such as EMDR, ego state therapy. It's very, very, very therapeutic. But that doesn't cure me. It just keeps me at a baseline of sanity.
Richard, we speak a lot with other survivors who have turned to advocacy, and something that's said quite a bit is, you know, we didn't choose this, right? None of us woke up and said, this is what we necessarily want to do. And so listening to everything you just said,
about advocacy or the abuse,
but both, right? I mean, you know, we didn't necessarily ask to fight this battle. We were brought into it, right? And hearing you speak, how do you maintain your own healing while helping others who aren't maybe as far along as you are? Because, you know, you've always been, even on social media, which I encourage our listeners to go find you at, you've always been very articulate. You're very outspoken. You're very confident. So how are you balancing that out? I mean, you're a fighter, but you've also been hurt.
Oh, so it's all about, some of it is about leadership. Your father is a prime example. I followed his lead when I decided that I would leave the Catholic Church. It doesn't mean that I'm not faithful. I mean, I have a very strong relationship with God and Jesus Christ and Michael and Raphael. But that's part of it. And maybe that's the foundation, is faith. Life's hard, man. So I do the ego state therapy as an adjunct and primer to EMDR therapy. I was on medication, but it made me worse. I got off of it. I got better. Stopped drinking, of course. The way that you get through the day is support from your loved ones. You know, I mean, my wife Maribel, this marriage is—it's a love story for the ages, and I wouldn't be anywhere where I am right now without her. And how else do you do it? You be patient. The thing about when you come out as a survivor, you have the misplaced shame and guilt. And then you tell your story for the first time. And here's what happens next. You get very, very angry, extremely angry. And so you have to learn how to control your emotions. In that specific period, everything that you see is going to trigger you, you know? And you have to learn how to take a deep breath. Walk back. There's nothing you can do. Also, what is extremely helpful to me is transcendental meditation.
So, Richard, when growing up, you said the abuse started when you were seven. Were your parents, at what point did they find out about your abuse?
That's a really good question. And I don't know if you want to hear the truth or not, but...
the truth is what we want to hear.
Okay, so... we were poor in New Orleans. My mother put me in the Boy Scouts. The Boy Scouts came canvassing the neighborhoods looking for single parent homes where they could enlist the children into the Boy Scouts. I mean, a pedophile ring, international pedophile ring. And so I was in the Boy Scouts. And all of a sudden, and remember, we're poor. All of a sudden, the lights didn't go out. All of a sudden, my mother didn't have to find money and hustle to NOPSI to pay the electric bill. All of a sudden, the landlord got off of our butt. And about the rent, you know, and the story went public. The Boy Scout story went public, and it's nothing like it is today. You know, I was sitting in the court. There is a sketch artist, and I'm on a stand in front of a bunch of adults and got the media there and everything. And it's not a position a young boy should be in.
How old were you at this 12, point?
11, 12. Okay. About 11, 12. Yeah. And the sketch artist did an incredible job of drawing me like a Mona Lisa, and they released that on the news, and everybody found out that I was the Ricky. And when my mother found out, she cried. My dad, who was an absent dad, by the way, they were separated at the time, he came over raging, and he said, "It's your fault. You should have been watching him. How dare you?" A Navy chief, retired Navy chief, World War II guy. And they argued about it right in front of me. They're arguing about whose fault it was. And then my dad went down to the corner bar. He got drunk. And he said, "I'm going to kill those MFers." That's what he told me when he left the house. And then he goes to the corner bar and he gets drunk and he tells the entire bar that I'm raising a faggot. And then the bar, good guys, they ran him out of town. Never saw him again. So that's it. You know, I've had a cadre of extraordinary men come in and out of my lives that I consider my mentors, and I wouldn't have survived without them. Oh, and here's the deal, Letitia. Yes, my mother knew about my abuse because a psychologist, when I was around 27 years old, said, "Richard, you need to go down to criminal district court, the clerk of court, and you need to get the transcripts of the entire trials, including your testimony, so that you can understand what really happened." Wow, that was a mistake. That was a huge mistake. I got the transcripts. I read them. And it turns out that my mother also testified in the Boy Scout trials. And the prosecutor hit her really hard. And it turned out, according to her own testimony and words, is that she suspected at some point that I was being abused by the Boy Scouts. She approached the Boy Scout masters and brought it to their attention. And the conclusion of that conversation was that to have continued access to me, they would pay her electric bill and her rent.
Oh, my goodness. So they were basically paying her off.
Yeah. She sold me for continued access to me. She knew exactly what was going on. She went to them, and they made a deal. I don't know how else to say it. They made a deal. And boy, does that throw you into, emotionally, does that throw you into a tailspin and know that your own mother participated and was rewarded financially for access to a child? Really?
I have like no words for that. Like, I wouldn't even know what to say to another woman who would not protect her own child from something like this. So I really don't... I don't know what to say, but I think people, I hope that your story helps people who are very judgmental towards victims and survivors to understand that the things that you've had to overcome, not just with the abuse.
About the skeptics.
The skeptics. Well, and those who are very judgmental and you know, think people are lying and all. There's always a background story. There's always a story.
And let me give you the demographics of the skeptics. They're pedophiles or there are elderly aging laity in the Catholic Church.
Yes.
And they believe that professional wrestling is real and the space program is fake. Even C. Amoeba understand that this happened.
So, right. Richard, this
I don't have any charity for them. But I don't.
So, Richard, this is I think a good for me at least a good transition into a discussion that I wanted to have. So, you know, in the realm of clerical sex abuse, it is much more likely, even though there's still the skeptics there, but it's much more likely someone is okay with softly admitting that there is a sex abuse problem in the Boy Scouts. But when it comes to the religious, that's where they draw the line. Oh, well, look, I might believe
Father
there's...
Father Joe could never do
he
that.
He would never do
that's
that.
Not true.
He baptized never. My baby. He married my mm-hmm. grandmother. And when he comes over yep. to the house, he brings bread. And, I mean, how could he do something? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that...
called grooming, by the way.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Community grooming, family grooming. One of the things that always catches me is, you know, a lot of times survivors, advocates get angry. A lot of times they say mean things. And if you All were right. speaking about a corporate entity, they would say, Richard, that's exactly how you should speak to them. Those bastards don't deserve niceties, right? But the moment you go into, you use that language when you're speaking about the institution of the Catholic Church or the laity, you know, everything starts to get fuzzy. So when it comes to the Jesuits, how did you handle that? And how did that differ from your experiences with coming out and speaking out against the Boy Scouts?
Well, I'm trying to piece together your question, but I will tell you that the Catholic Church is the oldest organized crime ring on the planet since the beginning of man. The Catholic Church, according to my research and Tom Dole's research, is in 390 AD approximately. Nobody can agree on the exact year. There was the Synod of Elvira, which was held in modern-day Granada, Spain. And they, back then, recognized that they had a problem with pedophile priests in the clergy. And back then, I guess according to the times, the penalty for violating a child as a priest was very severe. You know, you were immediately laicized, stripped of all of your priestly duties and responsibilities, and you would not receive the sacrament on your deathbed. So this is not something that's been going on since the 20s, 2000s, or 90s, 80s, 70s, 50s, 60s. This has been going on for almost two millennia. The mafia in Italy actually learns their tradecraft from the church. It is the organized, institutionalized, and wholesale rape of our children. And try as I may to fix it, you know, I've instigated FBI investigation and IRS investigation. The amount of respect that I have for the hierarchy, you know, I don't call him Archbishop Amon. And I talk to him occasionally. I call him Greg. Right?
Yeah.
Because you cannot get on camera and lie bold face to me. I don't know about your Catholic formation, but at 5 years old, if I told a lie, I was going straight to hell. But yet they bold face lie. You're in the business of telling the truth. What the hell's going on? You're no longer my moral authority. You're no longer my confessor. And I followed your dad's example. I thank God for your dad. That's exactly what I needed. Done.
Well, you know, we had Christy on the last podcast, and she spoke about, she's a litigator, and she specializes in sex abuse cases. And she was our litigator against the Diocese of Lafayette. And she said something really telling on the podcast. She spoke about litigating against, she had talked about, you know, the difference between litigating against religious organizations versus secular organizations. And she said, hands down, Catholic organizations, Christian organizations are far more aggressive and underhanded in their legal tactics than any secular organization.
Oh my God. And yeah, and you expect them to be pastoral in their response, but they lawyer a boy. And you know, when I went public with my the Jesuits, hired attorneys and investigators and went out into my childhood neighborhood and approached my family, trying to get words out of their mouth to discredit me. Who does that? Would Jesus ever do that?
I think one thing, Richard, people don't understand to go beyond the anger and the bitterness that survivors are having. And I think it kind of comes sort of in waves, the anger or the bitterness or both. What can we say to people to make them understand, look farther than that, look beyond that, because it's not a lack of faith on their part, for the most part, because you still had a faith, right? You were married. You and your wife?
I still do.
Yeah. So it's not that you abandoned faith and all of a sudden you're now some sort of demon running around, you know, trying to steal anybody's faith. You are trying to help other children from what, or to save them from the pain and the suffering that you had. But people only see the anger and bitterness.
It makes you laugh and cry when Pope Ratzinger personally called me the great accuser.
Yeah.
It just does something to you. And, the anger, everybody's individual. It's not just about church and Boy Scouts, but the biggest demographic is family abuse. You know, the mother, father, grandparents, drunk uncle, babysitter. And so the victims and survivors, in my experience, have different experiences. They're very, very unique. And, For the victims and survivors that were raised Catholic and that they were faithful, it really weighs on them. And you know, there's how do you console a heart like that? How do you give them peace? I haven't figured out the answer to that question yet. Only to just be by their side, stop talking, start listening. I give them a very, very wide berth. I want them to get it out. I want them to vomit it. I want them to say the details, to get it out of their system. And unfortunately, we've had miraculous recoveries in my organization. And we've also buried about four or five people. And it's just a balancing act. We don't have nothing to go on. You know, it's sad. But could you understand their anger? And I have people say this to me all the time. Richard, I understood what you went through. Really? Would you tell a Vietnam vet that you know what they went through? I just want to punch them in the throat, you know?
Yeah, I never...
Never know exactly what I went through. You know, there's the old adage that walk a mile in my shoes. If you walked 6 inches in my shoes, you would collapse. It's that horrific and disturbing. So that's my answer.
Yeah, I quit telling people I understand what you went through, because I don't. I don't even understand what my own son went through. I know what we witnessed and what we saw. And from that, I know sort of how to talk to people, because I know that I can't truly understand. But when I talk to survivors or they've telling me their story for the first time, I think it's important for people to understand, just to listen And I know sometimes people mean well by saying certain things, like, I understand what you're saying, but that.
Maybe, I know they mean well, but boy.
Yeah, it hurts. So,
well, and, you know, Richard brings up a good point that I want the listeners to really take in. And it's the listening part. It's sometimes not saying anything. I know there's this almost politeness to want to say things, fix things, attempt to fix things. But sometimes, I mean, even with me, not even a survivor here, just the family member of one. And sometimes someone would ask me how I'm doing, and I just start talking. And of course it is dark. It is uncomfortable. It is awkward. That's one way to make a conversation mm-hmm. awkward immediately. And I'm the same mm-hmm. as you, Richard. They would say, well, have you thought about, and I'm like, God dang it. Stop. No, I don't tell right. me to go
You're
pray
not
this.
In a
don't
tell me to give me advice.
Yes. I just wanted to get it out. I wasn't asking you to, you can't, you're not going to know how to quote unquote fix what I'm going through. And I think mm-hmm. that was one of the biggest things with counseling that I liked, was that my counselors never attempted a quote unquote fix. All they did was listen, mm-hmm. ask questions. And I think I had a fantastic, fantastic counselor out here. And I know that she, when I look back at it, I realized that she led me to things, but she never told me things. She let me get there
That's
through
right.
questions, but she never told me anything. She never said, this is what you need to do. So I just want the listeners to really take that to heart.
Talk therapy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic. But I think that's a very important, because I want to make sure too, that they realize that doesn't mean that there is no hope to be silent or to say that you aren't going to be able to offer that one thing that quote unquote fixes it. That doesn't mean that there's no hope there. It's just that that's not going to help, or most of the time, at least it doesn't help. Just listening is a lot of times what, what's
your
needed.
Mother knows my thought on hope. You know, my wife is the most incredible woman in the world. You know, my first wife, you know, she's like, you will not bring the shame on the family. And my wife is a psychiatric nurse, my current wife and my final wife. And she, early in the marriage, she said, Richard, I know what you're going through. She loves me. She knows me, but she will never, ever know the horrors that I experience. And if it was possible, I wouldn't allow it, because I don't want my toxic brain and hers.
Richard, in your experiences, and I've asked this to most of the guests that we've brought onto the podcast, someone comes to you and your organization and says that they have mm-hmm. they have been abused, or they think they might have been abused. What do you tell them?
First, they're assigned a point person. First off, SESA is not co-ed. We separate the sexes, because Sally doesn't want to know the details of my abuse, and Bobby doesn't want to know the details of Brenda's abuse. And, you know, in other organizations, there are very strict rules as to support meetings and what you can and cannot say. We not only allow, but we encourage our members to say everything. And that's so important. It's so important. The support meetings are critical. I mean, you know, fellowship is probably the best answer that we have. You know, like I told you earlier, my wife, she said that she understands what I went through. She doesn't. But I can sit in a support meeting and somebody brand new can come into it, and I can look into their eyes and I already know what they went through. There's some kind of visceral connection between victims and survivors. And part of the power of healing is that, you know, you can't talk to your wife and you can't talk to a lawyer. You can't talk to your neighbor. You can't talk to your kids. You can't talk to anybody. But once you get in that room with fellow victims and survivors, you understand that you're not alone. And there is a community that will support you. I call it the 12th step. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are 12 steps, you know, to getting over alcohol. And the 12th step is the most important. And they say that if you do all 11 steps and you don't do the 12th step, you will drink again. And a 12th step, what is that? It's fellowship. You know, I have a rough time going to the American Legion and buddying up with all my veteran guys and talking honestly and frankly about what happened to me. But in the support meeting, it's totally different. And I just get them emotionally vomit. And they, not my wife, not the police, not the court, not the church, they understand automatically. They understand. And in that space, you know, there's an incredible amount of empathy and understanding. And that is so beneficial. Every week, the show must go on. We never cancel a support meeting. Sometimes, you know, we have our victims and survivors that, you know, on a Wednesday are having a bad time. And so we do one-on-one with them. And you said, Alex, you know, people that think that they were molested. I can tell you a story about Benny. He's almost 80. He lives in Tennessee. That's all I'm going to say about his identity. And he had been haunted all of his life by the worst nightmares of him being molested. But in his waking moments, he couldn't recall it. And so we referred him to a psychologist. And he had some other things he had to deal with. But this is an elderly man. And almost at 80, going through counseling, he was able to absolutely, vividly, with detail, recall his abuse. That's pure human suffering. I don't know how else to describe it.
That's exactly why I said think, by the way, just because I've seen that lately. I hate any time that this reaches the public square, because it's always discussed in the most idiotic way. But I saw that repressed memories has come back into the lexicon, especially in the church sex abuse. You know, and people have said that it's, you know, people have said that it's made up. People have said, but I've spoken with people through social media who have dealt with this. And as you said, it's disgusting. It is purely just it's suffering of the highest degree. Right. And it's the same thing, you know, the nightmares, weird memories, and a lot of times they are older. They're in their 70s. You know, so I'm glad that you brought up his story, just because I think that's an important, it shows also the power of the human mind, right? To be able to shove that so far back that it becomes just a dream or a distant memory. I guess it's the body in self defense.
He's a really good guy.
So, Richard, are you a veteran as well?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm sitting here listening to you speak. You're a veteran. You are actually, I guess, Dr. Winman, Dr. Richard Winman. You have your PhD.
Yeah, but don't call me Dr. Winman. I tried that when I first got my degree and people laughed at me.
I know, but I guess I'm trying to make the point is that you're a very well-educated man. You're not just some nut off the street. But that's just so unfair to say anyway, because so many of these people on the street are hurting from some trauma that's probably happened to them anyway. But people want to put abuse survivors in a box, I think, where they can say, well, they're just crazy. They have nothing good to say. They have nothing to bring to society. And yet here you are, an American hero, a doctor, a man who's had a successful career. Well, you've served our country, Richard. So in my mind, that's, you're an American hero. You know, you've done a lot of good things. And at some point, all of these childhood memories needed to come out. And I don't know exactly what, well, you said the Sandusky. But it has cost you a lot as well. And I think people need to understand where survivors come from. No one wants to come out with this and face this. And, you know, listening to your story, seeing what's happened to us and to my family, who wants that? So when you come out, there's a passion and a purpose for it.
And you understand this, I think, Leticia, just as well as I do. So when you abuse a child, you don't just harm the child. You harm the entire family. It has reverberating effects. So, you know, my dad got drunk and said he was raised as a faggot, never saw him anymore. My mother went into a very, very deep depression that she never recovered from. And all of a sudden, oops, I'm the man in the house. Really? I'm being raped and I'm the man in the house. And, you know, and so, you know, I had jobs in addition to going to school. And it's, you know, it's the same for other families. I mean, when you rape, and your family, Leticia, is a perfect example of that. How has it affected Alex? And how has it affected your husband? And and let's not forget about the true victim, right? I mean, they destroyed you in a single act.
I think it was it was either our attorney or one of my counselors, I forget which one, who had said that the best example she could give was that the act was analogous to a suicide bombing. You have the initial detonation, the people closest to the bomber are affected, but then you've got the shrapnel. And so then you've got the people who are a little further away, but then you've got the families of everyone in there as well. And so she said, you know, because I mean, I remember when our case went public, I remember one of the craziest things was that Oliver and I both were getting messages from people who we hadn't spoken to in years, who were messaging us, and they were like, "We are devastated. I can't believe this. This is destroyed. I left the church the moment, you know." And they're just discussing this heartfelt, like, just it affected them. And these were people that we hadn't spoken to in years, but it was raw when they were telling us about how they felt upon hearing it, and they offered support, they listened, there were people I connected with that I hadn't spoken to in years that followed the case, who don't even live in the state, who would message me when things would come up in the news, and they'd go, "Hey, stay strong, thinking of you, thinking of your family," you know. And so these were people who I would have never imagined would be affected by what happened here. Mm-hmm. And they're so far removed from my family, it's unbelievable. Most of them had never even met Oliver. I mean, this was the first time they knew I had a brother.
You want to know some of the calls I get? Happens about twice a month. It'll be late at night, and my phone will go off, and I'll answer it. And I have to answer the phone because I have victims and survivors on the ledge. So I can't not answer a phone call. And pick up the phone. "Are you Richard Winman?" "Yes, I am." "Are you the Richard Winman?" "Yeah, there's only two of us on the end. In the entire planet. The other one's my son. Hey, I was on a dark web and I saw your kiddie porn, and boy, is it hot." That's my life. Those are the calls that I get. And it's just, you know, and when you think about it, excuse my language, you know, it was because one guy wanted to get his nut, and he got it one time. and it was over. And he destroyed many, many lives in his wake.
And generations. That's, I mean, I think of, because you know, what happened to you, then you've got your children that are collateral damage, as we say, which sounds so cold, but they are also suffering from what happened to you. It'll be generations before someone does not know your story.
Oh, many generations, you know, and my God, you know, I think about my grandchildren and the shit that they're going to have to go through because of what I went through, you know. I wonder about how they're going to be teased in school, you know, when they Google my name. Yeah, it's disturbing.
Take 2 or 3 minutes. What do you hope to achieve with your advocacy, number one? And number two, we know the demographic of our podcast includes survivors, families of survivors. And of course, you can't discount the possibility that some of our listeners are survivors who are struggling, who are at their lowest. So what is your message to them?
You know, advocacy, I never wanted to be an advocate. It was the last thing I wanted to do. You know, when I went public, people just came to me. And normally I have a hard time saying no to anybody, but especially victim or survivor of childhood sex abuse. How do I look them in the eye and tell them that, you know, sorry, you know, let me give you a referral to another organization? How do you say no to them? You know, it's very, very, very hard. I did volunteer for it. It's an ugly business. I don't like it, but I love it. It's advocacy for me. And I'm running for office, you know, in Texas for state representative. And the platform is, you know, of course, child protection and sanctity. And it's like an addiction. Advocacy is like an addiction to me, which is kind of okay because it doesn't have any health side effects. And you can stand tall and proud, and you can actually help people. You can, just by listening. I mean, you know, we have medicines with micrograms and milligrams and shots and pills and everything, but what I found out, you know, is just listening is the most important thing. And what was the second half of the two-parter?
What's your message to the listeners who are comprised of regular everyday laity, people who aren't religious at all, and there's quite a few survivors as well, and family members of survivors. What's your message to them?
First off, as a matter of fact, it actually happened, and it continues to happen, and it's part of a playbook. Not maybe the actual abuse, but the cover-up, and then the cover-up of the cover-up. So, you know, you're facing some really evil people right now. But to the parents, I would say, you know, throw the ball with your boy. Attend your daughter's tea party in her room. You know, stop using institutions such as the church and Boy Scouts as a free babysitting service. You have to keep eyes on your child all the time. And, you know, unfortunately, it's insidious, you know, so you can't trust the drunk uncle or even the babysitter with your kid. And it's just the horrible world that we live in right now. And it is evil. To the survivors, I would say, going public, is it a good thing to do? Well, yeah, it is a good thing to do. And maybe you should do it, but, you know, your life is going to be better, but it's going to be different. You're going to lose some people. Even the people closest to me that love me and support me, they are very, very, very careful about how they approach me on everyday things. You know, it's very awkward existence. I do think it's worth it. Raising awareness is our number one tool. Also, to the Catholic victims and survivors, never, ever, ever go to the victim's assistance coordinator at the church. We've seen this time and time again. Instead of going to the police or getting a lawyer, you go to the church. You complain to your own abusers about your abuse, and they take tedious, tedious notes and records. And when you do get an attorney, they will, and they have, used your own words against you. Don't ever think. And it's really hard because I don't want to condemn the church in general, but don't ever think that you were raped as a child and you can go to the church and they'll help you. Don't ever think that. You are very, very, very vulnerable. And why would you even go to the church about your abuse? The first thing you need to do is go to the police department and file a complaint. And they'll go and they'll say this. Oh, well, that was decades ago. You know, a statute of limitations doesn't apply. They have a duty, a fiduciary responsibility to file your report, and you must demand it. And the reason that you do that is to form documentation, to start the documentation. And then you need to get an attorney. And then you need support. And if you're a victim or survivor that's listening out there and you think that you're the only one and that nobody understands you, I would invite you to come to our meetings and join our organization.
Well, Richard, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for telling your story. Thank you so much for being honest and raw, which is what we want for this podcast. So I thank you for coming on. I thank you for taking the risk on us. And hopefully there'll be some opportunities in the future for Tent Makers and maybe even another podcast.
Well, Alex and Leticia, I want to thank you for having me in the first place. I'm small and humble in your efforts to try to get some kind of answer or healing for people. You know, it wasn't long ago, you know, Leticia and I were in Baton Rouge and testifying before legislature to get that bill passed. And I appreciate you guys and everything you do. And I don't want to say it like that, but yeah, I want to say I know your pain, but I feel your pain, you know? And God bless you and your family.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, that Richard. Means a lot.
You're welcome.
Have a good day. As we draw the curtain on this episode of Resilience in the Shadows, our most profound appreciation goes to Richard Windman for sharing his journey of resilience and advocacy. Richard's courage and determination are a beacon of hope, guiding us through the shadows and toward healing and justice. Throughout our conversation, Richard's insights have shed light on the pervasive nature of childhood sexual abuse and the critical importance of prevention efforts. His unwavering commitment to raising awareness and supporting survivors is inspiring. If Richard's story has moved you and you wish to support the vital work of survivors of childhood sex abuse, we encourage you to visit their website at www.scsaorg.org. There, you'll find valuable resources, information on upcoming initiatives, and ways to contribute to their mission. At Tentmakers, we aim to bring impactful stories like Richard's and foster hope, healing, and justice through our Resilience in the Shadows podcast and our work at Tentmakers of Louisiana. please consider donating to Tent Makers through our website at www.tentmakers.la to keep our podcast going and support our mission. Your contribution will help us continue to shine a light on important issues and make a difference in the lives of survivors and advocates. Thank you once again for being part of this experience. Those intrigued by Richard's story and wanting to delve deeper, please consider reaching out to him through the SCSA website. Join us in this ongoing journey, and until next time, take care, stay resilient, and consider being the light in someone's shadows.